Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled, Does America Have a Future? We invite our audience to visit us often at the internet, on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events which are held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. John Thomas, also known as the Mad Hedge Fund Trader, who publishes a daily newsletter under that name, graduated from UCLA with a degree in biochemistry and a minor in mathematics in 1974. He then moved to Tokyo, Japan, to join Dainana Securities as a research analyst of Japanese companies, becoming fluent in Japanese. In 1976, he was appointed the Tokyo correspondent for The Economist magazine and the Financial Times. For the next 7 years, he published thousands of articles about the economies, companies, and leaders of every country in Asia. He was one of the first American correspondents to cover China during the Cultural Revolution. He interviewed major figures like China's Premier Deng Xiaoping, Ferdinand Marcos of the Philippines, the UK's Margaret Thatcher, the PLO's Yasser Arafat, and President Ronald Reagan. In 1982, John moved to New York as the U.S. editor of Euro Money magazine and was a member of the White House Press Corps. In 1983, he was hired by Morgan Stanley to build a new division in international equities. In 1985, he was promoted to vice president and transferred to London to head up the sales and trading of Japanese equity derivatives in Europe and the Middle East. In 1989, John was appointed a director of the Swiss Bank Corp, responsible for its then vast portfolio of Japanese equity derivatives. A year later, in 1990, he left to set up the first ever dedicated international hedge fund, which became a top performer in the industry. And I just learned tonight that also in 1990, he had a little stop off on the Desert Storm engagement, where he was drafted into the military and flew support aircraft for a while at that time. In 1999, John sold his hedge fund to concentrate on managing his personal investments. Missing the adrenaline of the marketplace, he returned to active hedge fund investment in 2008. He has always devoted his life to understanding global capital markets, not because of money he could make there necessarily, but because of the limitless intellectual challenges it offered. He created his website, madhedgefundtrader.com, and publishes his daily newsletter to air his iconoclastic, out-of-consensus, and often radical ideas in public, as well as to vent on the matters of the world at large. In his free time, John climbs mountains, does long-distance backpacks, practices karate, performs aerobatics in vintage aircraft, collects vintage wines, reads the Japanese classics, and engages in a wide variety of public service and philanthropic activities. Now, why they call him mad, he will never understand. Will you please join me in welcoming John Thomas?
Well, thank you for that kind introduction, Tom. I assure you at least 40% of it is true. Before I get started, let me tell you that if you want any slides or any of the data in this presentation, you can get it at my website at blog.madhedgefundtrader.com. You can also sign up there if you want to get on our research mailing list, which is appropriately priced at free. Let me start out by telling you how hedge funds think. Tom asked me to do this lecture in March of this year. Since then, the Shanghai market has risen by 75%. South Korea is up 60%, and the U.S. is up 52%. So if you want to ask what the markets are going to do, don't ask me. Ask Tom. He's sitting there in the back row. Hedge funds are always looking for a new angle, always looking for opportunities. Tom, you could be the beginning of a trillion-dollar industry if you just got organized. What is a hedge fund? A mutual fund, which you all know about, invests in stocks. Hedge funds invest in stocks, but they take away money from bad companies. Hedge funds charge fees of 1% usually and a performance bonus of 20%. Mutual funds charge fixed fees of 0.5% to 2%. Hedge funds today account for between 50 and 70% of the trading volume in all markets. So they are a huge factor in the financial system today. A lot of that is computer-driven. No humans are involved. And one subsector of the hedge fund industry involves a competitive advantage on how fast can you get electricity to go down fiber optic cables. They're competing in tens, hundreds, and thousands of seconds. A favorite phrase of ours in the business, you can't eat relative performance. The goal of a hedge fund is to always make money no matter what, whether the market goes up, whether the market goes down. Last year, some mutual funds said they had a great year because they were only down 40% and their benchmark index was down 50%. Hedge fund managers usually get fired when they lose more than 20%. Although they are being vilified these days on Capitol Hill, hedge funds actually perform a public service. They add huge amounts of liquidity to the markets, without which large institutions like CalPERS, the California Pension Fund System, would not be able to buy and sell the positions that they have. And by taking away money from bad companies and giving it to good companies, they greatly accelerate the rate of change in the U.S. economy. Japan didn't have hedge funds in the 90s, and they were able to drag on their economic problems for 20 years. Who can invest in hedge funds? It's for rich people initially. You need to be worth at least $5 million. By the way, if you do a search on the word sophisticated, of course James Bond is the first thing that pops up on Google. But everyone participates in hedge funds one way or another because chances are your pension fund is investing with many hedge funds, and your bank either is a hedge fund or has been investing with hedge funds. So everyone in this room participates in the business whether they understand it or not. The idea of a hedge fund initially was that you found a good company, you bought it, you found a bad company, you made a bet that it would go down, and the two would balance each other and therefore hedge each other. Since then, the industry has just grown astronomically. These are the major categories currently. Some you need a PhD from MIT in mathematics to understand what they are. But it has grown from a $100 million industry in my time to $2 trillion. The first hedge fund was started by a financial journalist, an editor at Fortune magazine in 1949, named Alfred Jones, and he carried on until 1970. Even in the 70s, there are just a tiny handful of hedge funds around. Michael Steinhardt was one of the earlier guys, but the industry had no more than $100 million under management and was no more than a blip on the radar at that time. The 1980s saw the emergence of really big hedge funds, George Soros, Julian Robertson, Paul Tudor Jones, and that's when the industry really started to take off. The 90s saw all those MBAs and MIT grads hit the system, and all of a sudden we had computers throwing around billions of dollars on a daily basis. And by the 2000s, the industry had grown so much that the new people coming in had very little value added. They were mostly copycat funds. Last year really was the demise of the hedge fund industry. They lost half the money they had under management, from $2 trillion down to $1 trillion, either through market losses or redemptions. And you had too many young people pursuing identical strategies at the same time. They assumed that the markets would always be there. In fact, what happened is when the first one went to sell, they all went to sell, and the markets closed. And if the markets are closed, you can't value your positions, and then your accountants tell you, well, until you come up with a value, I'm going to value your position at zero. And this is basically what dragged the entire banking system down with it, is because they all had the same securities, which also had to be marked at zero or 20% of face or 30 or whatever they came up with. The problem with hedge funds, this is my favorite quote from John Maynard Keynes, markets can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. John Maynard Keynes was a Nobel Prize winning economist who functioned essentially as a hedge fund himself in England in the 30s, made a ton of money, and then eventually went bust. Unfortunately, the markets did not contemplate Kathleen Casey Kerschling. This woman was born 1 second after midnight on January 1st, 1946, thereby becoming the first ever baby boomer. She retired on February 12, 2008, at the age of 62. Here you see the head of the Social Security Administration handing her her first Social Security check. And this event would have massive implications for the financial system, which were not foreseen by most hedge funds, most banks, and most everyone. There are 80 million baby boomers in the United States today, born between 1946 and 1954. 10,000 a day are retiring, which means Social Security turns cash flow negative by 2017, and Social Security runs out of money in 2041. I'm sure these are very optimistic figures, and you know it'll really run out of money much sooner. What happens when baby boomers get old? They move from McMansions to retirement condos to assisted living facilities. This is going on now in an absolutely massive scale. And the downsizing per couple goes from 2,500 square feet to 200 square feet. Multiply times 80 million, and you have some idea on the total reduction in demand that's been going on in real estate really since about 2005. Now, if you work in the real estate industry, you may want to get up, exercise, go to the bathroom, have a cigarette, whatever, because the next part is going to be pretty scary. What essentially, if you have to give a one-liner on the cause of the financial crisis, the largest supply of houses in history hit the weakest demand for houses in history at exactly the same time. Just as easy financing, liar loans, massive overbuilding created this gigantic supply of houses, the buyers of houses shrank tremendously. Now, if you had gone over population demographic data, you could have predicted this was going to happen 30 years ago. But not very many people do that because demographic and population data is really quite boring. But it's all up there on the internet for anyone to see. The net decline in housing demand being caused by the baby boomer generation retiring is 7 billion square foot a year, or one San Francisco a year, in terms of shrinkage of demand for housing. There are a couple of houses out there for sale right now. I calculated at 26 million, which interestingly is almost exactly the number of homes owned by baby boomers. And that is about a five-year supply of houses if we go at the current rate of about 5 million houses a year. Of course, the stock market didn't like this very much. This is world stock market capitalization. It dropped from $62 trillion to $29 trillion in about 6 months. The world literally dropped by half in 6 months. And the same thing happened with corporate bonds, real estate, and almost any asset you can think of dropped in value by an equal amount. This is a chart for U.S. Steel, went from $180 to $18 in 6 months, which interestingly is what it did during the Great Depression. It dropped by 90%. And factory utilization dropped by 50% in 6 months. This was the impact on the GDP growth. We went from 3.5% to minus 6%, actually, was the final number. This is a little out of date. This shows you employment trends of every recession since World War II, and we are the red line. Let's see. Oops. Let's go back. That's us now. And I don't see an uptrend in there anywhere. Every other recession since World War II, we've had turnarounds and then sharp V-shaped recoveries or U-shaped recoveries. So this is by far and away the most severe recession we've had since the 30s. This is the Case-Shiller Real Estate Price Index, which shows you how much house prices have gone down in the last 2 years and where the damage has been. All you can say now is thank goodness you don't live in Miami. They had the highest peak and the biggest fall off. But then the people in Miami should say, well, thank goodness we don't live in Detroit, where prices have dropped back to 1994 levels. San Francisco is sort of the middle of the pack. It's right here. And we still are showing positive gains for the 21st century. But that may not last much longer. Last Friday, Deutsche Bank put out a report saying that they expect residential real estate prices to drop another 14% in 2 years, and that will create a new concept, and that is the negative equity city. Cities that have no home equity in them at all. Las Vegas is at the head of the herd right now to win that title, but the other four cities are in California, unfortunately. And the causes of these negative equities are these types of loans, which I'm sure you've all heard about. How bad can it get? This is Japanese real estate prices from 1980 to 2005. And I was trading the Japanese market during this time. And, you know, when you got that first 10% drop, people just piled in. They thought, what a deal. And I said, no, thank you. They're still going down. I mean, real estate prices in Japan have been going down for 20 years. Well, hedge funds are in the business of making money no matter what. There's no such thing as an excuse, so where are they going to go next? They're looking for growth on a global basis, and they want to get out of the dollar. And paper assets are going out of favor. You don't want to own anything that's made out of paper because printing presses are never that far away. That means you don't want to own stocks in the U.S., and you don't want to own bonds, especially government bonds in the U.S. This is expected GDP growth rates for the world. This figure for China has actually been revised up to 9%. India's at 4%. We're down here at minus 2.49. The final number will probably come in worse than that. So there's a lot of interest in emerging markets because of the huge differentials you're seeing in international growth rates now. But this is not exactly new news. The countries that are growing the fastest are also the most expensive. Taiwan is selling at 60 times earnings. China's at 29 times. It's much higher than that now. It's probably closer to 40. The United States is at 14, you know, on its way back to 12 or 11. The dollar has not been a good bet since 1929. It actually hasn't been a great bet since the Revolutionary War. This is a 225-year chart for the dollar. No, I have not been trading the dollar since the Revolutionary War, but I have had some close relatives who did. Betting against the dollar has been one of the surest things out there. When I got into the business 40 years ago, we were just going off the gold standard, and there were 4 Deutschmarks to the dollar, there were 5 French francs, there were 3 Swiss francs, and the most valuable asset I own today is my European vacation of 1968. This is what it's done for the last 25 years, and the interesting thing here is we are about to break down. We're here. And many hedge funds, if not all, are betting we get a big breakdown very soon in the U.S. dollar. So how do you cope with this? You don't have to be a big international hedge fund with a 24-hour trading desk to protect your assets in this situation. Anybody can invest in strong economies with strong currencies. And this is the emerging market argument. Their currencies are strong. They're growing at 5 times the rate that ours. Would you rather invest in the U.S. that's growing at 1% a year or China at 9%? You know, guess what gets you the better return? Interest rates are falling in emerging markets. They have little or no debt, ironically, because they didn't have the credit quality to borrow. We wouldn't lend it to them because we thought they were no good. Emerging markets don't have baby boomers. That's a huge plus. They have little or no debt, and since many are former colonies of European powers, their economies are largely built around natural resources. You want to buy what the Chinese are doing. You want to buy anything that someone else is buying and has $2.2 trillion. That's a good rule of thumb. And that is what China's reserves are today, and they are going up by approximately $100 billion a month. The Chinese are massive buyers today of oil, copper, iron ore. They dominate all of these markets. They don't have enough of their own, so they have to buy from us what they can't get locally to develop their own economy. Just to show you how some of the emerging markets have done this year, India's up 90%, China's up 87% against the Dow Jones, which is up only 6% this year. So this is one of the reasons why hedge funds have been pouring into international markets. Commodities are another area that you want to be looking at. Again, buy what the Chinese are buying. The rule of thumb is if you drop it on your foot and it hurts, you buy it. And again, this is part of the shift out of paper into real things. Another big trend which isn't getting too much mainstream media coverage is the coming food shortage. We had a green revolution in the 60s, which bought us 30 years of grace because of fertilizers, better seed varieties, and so on. That grace period is now over, and the world is going to run out of food. The Chinese, with their better standard of living, turns out they want to eat more meat. The problem with shifting the Chinese from a grain to meat is that it takes 16 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of beef. Anything agricultural related, I've got some companies down here. Potash is a fertilizer company. Monsanto makes seeds. Agrium is another fertilizer company. You can buy agricultural ETFs, exchange-traded funds. This one's got a symbol called MOO. That's going to be a huge growth area for the world, but also for the United States especially, because they have the leading technologies for the implements of agricultural production. Water is something that's also going to become very big, although you're not hearing about it now. A fresh water shortage is another big crisis that's headed our way, and which no one is doing anything about it. That 1 pound of beef that took 16 pounds of grain to produce requires 2,416 gallons of water. Now, the United States is fairly well fixed on the waterfront. China is the worst. Up to 90% of Chinese water supplies are polluted. Some of them are so polluted they can't even be reconstituted. They have heavy metals in them or seriously poisonous. So that is going to be another big growth industry. There are not very many stocks in this area you can buy publicly, but they're going to be. Back to the topic of the lecture, does America have a future? We've been living beyond our means for a long time, living like a rock star, like Michael Jackson, living like a rock star for 20 years with no hits. We've had 30 years of overconsumption and undersaving. The saving rate this year has jumped up to 7% after being at zero or close to zero for 15 years. Unfortunately, when the saving rate goes from 1% to 7%, that takes $500 billion of consumer spending out of the picture in this country. And that's a lot of spending. So if you're wondering why your local shopping malls are emptying out and there are for lease signs everywhere, that's the reason. Recent drivers of the U.S. economy in the 1980s, we had the PCs. The 90s, we had the internet. We had our real estate bubble in 2000s, which turned out to be unsustainable. What happens next? Well, there are several possibilities. Right now, we're on track for what I call is the square root shape recovery, which means you get a sharp sell-off, which we've already had, a sharp bounce, and then sideways for a very long time. From 2002 to 2007, we averaged 3% a year of real GDP growth. If you allow for bank deleveraging, which means banks have gone back to the position where they only lend money to people who don't need it, that's going to cut 1% a year off our GDP growth. If you take the new frugality into consideration, that takes another 1%. So that leaves the U.S. with a real GDP growth of 1% for the next 10 years, which means the unemployment rate is permanently going to be stuck around 10%. Deflation will be endemic. The dollar will collapse. You can forget about real estate, and we have falling standards of living. By the way, the United States needs 37 million jobs for the next decade just to accommodate the current number of unemployed people plus natural population growth and some immigration. This is my favorite choice for getting out of the 1% growth scenario. We need a new energy infrastructure in this country. We had a brief vacation from high oil, which is ending. It went from $148 to $32 in the last year. We've made it back up to 76, and I think we're going a lot higher from here. You can sit around and wait for more dinosaurs to die and get turned into oil, or you can figure out ways to replace the oil. That's really our only option. I think the country should make this a national defense issue. Getting 70% of our imported oil from the Middle East was never a great idea to start with, but it was one of those things that just sort of happened. Every year we took in a little more without everyone really thinking about it. Wind and solar are developing into major industries. I didn't believe in solar for a long time, but in the last year, solar has gotten price competitive with other forms of energy production. You're looking at a cost now for solar of about 15 cents a kilowatt, and with tax subsidies, that comes down to 11 cents, which is close to what it costs most power companies to produce electricity. Exxon is experimenting with algae. That's going to be very interesting. They've put $600 million into that. You don't really want to live next door to their algae facility, but if we have to hold our noses to solve the energy crisis, so be it. Natural gas. Does anyone know that we've discovered 100 years of natural gas reserves in the last 3 years? Anyone not? Raise your hands. Okay, well, that's more than I thought. Turns out the United States is sitting on a gigantic pool of untapped free energy while we're having this energy crisis. All you have to do is just drill down and get it. The problem is that to build the infrastructure to use that natural gas costs $500 billion and will take 10 years. Boone Pickens has been pushing his Pickens plan to use natural gas as a 20-year bridge until all the other alternatives have a chance to kick in. Since he proposed that plan, the price of natural gas has dropped by 70%. So natural gas is in your future. California actually is already the highest natural gas user in the country. PG&E gets 50% of its power generation from natural gas. If you run a car on natural gas, you only need a tune-up every 100,000 miles. And at 100,000 miles, I've torn apart a 100,000-mile engine, and it looks like a new engine. So you can expect a lot more natural gas usage. Hybrid cars will be big in the future, and this could be a huge part of our industry. Biotech is another area which can be big. If the 20th century was the century of electricity, the 21st century could be the century of biology. You know, if kids come up to me and say, gee, what should I do with my life? I say, well, I don't say plastics. I say biology and Mandarin, by the way. Mandarin and biology. You got those two and you might get a job. This is going to be a huge growth area. Cap and trade may or may not make it to the Congress. If they do, Goldman Sachs will make a fortune trading the cap and trade credits. The problem with cap and trade is that you're asking people to move from 3 cents a kilowatt electricity from coal to 15 cents a kilowatt alternative when they're broke. If you ask the government to do this, they're going to have to borrow it from China. So this is a big ticket item. We have to convert 400 plants. If you want to get CO2 out of the air, it's going to be expensive. If we do this, the average electricity bill will rise by 30%. On the other hand, you'll probably create 10 million jobs by doing this. So this is another. And if we develop an efficient cap-and-trade technology, we can then sell it. Sell it to China, sell it to everyone. And by the way, if a global cap-and-trade system comes into force, that basically is going to involve getting China to pay us money because they are huge producers of CO2, and I foresee that happening at some point in the future. Some quid pro quo. You can keep selling us stuff, but you've got to give us money for the CO2. Healthcare. Boy, am I sick of listening about this one. But the fact is that the healthcare industry is a 19th century industry. It's hugely fragmented. It's inefficient. It's poorly managed. It's redundant. If you go into your dentist office, you'll find one dentist and one lady who does full-time battling with insurance companies to get paid. I mean, that makes no sense whatsoever. There are 200 HMOs in the country. I mean, how many industries have 200 players? And we had three big car companies. We had 100 airlines. You know, there are very few industries that are so fragmented. And sheer rationalization and organization will save a huge amount of money and create investment opportunities for the people in there and job opportunities. But until the slugfest finishes in Washington, we really don't know what this is going to look like. But this could be a big job driver. You could do this for profit. I mean, reforming healthcare could be done for free if you did it right. It'd be nice to have a new interstate system. The one we have is falling apart. The nice thing about building an interstate is that by spending $1 trillion, you would create 35 million jobs, none of which can be exported to China. So it's a huge domestic job driver. Again, where are we going to get the money? That's the big problem. So are we going to have a square root shape recovery, or are we going to go to a V? It's really up to you people. It depends on your investment decisions, your career decisions, who you back politically, your level of activism. Just let me know what you decide so I can put my money to work accordingly. And do I have any questions? 40 minutes, how about that?
Well, let's put our hands together, please, for John. So I want to remind us, we're listening to John Thomas, a mad hedge fund trader and one of the hedge fund industry veterans. And as you can tell, he's got some wide-ranging views on a wide-ranging number of topics. So as we kind of dig into this, and I hope people are ready with some questions, if I may lead off, I'm interested in your views. And since you dig into this stuff, and we've chatted before a lot about the amount of reading you do each day and triangulate all these various sources of information and everything else, I was just curious about the view from 30,000 feet or even from much higher than that in terms of just the sheer complexity of it. Maybe this is more a philosophical question. I don't mean to necessarily take it there, but the sheer complexity of it all. And we humans strive for some kind of simplicity so we can kind of make sense of things and figure things out. And invariably, we end up with kind of superficial simplicity sometimes instead of some elegant simplicity that where we've made our way through the thicket of complexity. So you've touched on so many obviously important areas. And does our search for simplicity get in our way, and we really do need to accept the complexity of this all? Or are there really just a couple of things that we as individuals and maybe we as a society need to really bear into? And you obviously tried to have some prioritization when you talked about the energy infrastructure and so forth and so on. But anyway, what are your thoughts on this complexity versus simplicity thing, which can get us into trouble, I think?
Such a deep question. I don't think I can give you the 30,000-foot view on that one. I'll have to give you the 6-foot under view. The world was a lot simpler place when I first started doing this in the 60s. Globalization has really made things complicated. It used to be that when you looked at a stock, you looked at their U.S. business, fairly simple to understand, the stocks were cheap. That was that. Now you have to worry about what is the engineer thinking about in Mumbai? What are the Chinese doing in that area? Are the Europeans going to buy this? What do the regulators in Washington think I should do about this? It really has become vastly complicated. The thing about the investment business is I think it attracts a lot of people who think it's easy. All you have to do is buy a stock and watch it go up, and you don't have to do any work. The reality is you have to do twice as much work as everyone else to get this to succeed. So, you know, I would love to say, yes, it's easy. Just listen what I have to say. But, in fact, the world is getting more complicated all the time and will continue to do so. You know, when India and China were out of the picture for 200 years, we only had a third of the world to even think about. Now they're in the game. We have to consider everything they're doing, too, and in their languages. So that's what I think.
Well, just a quick follow-on question, if I may. And again, maybe not so much from the standpoint of the investment perspective, per se, but what about just the lives we live? The lives we live.
Well, unfortunately, the last decade or so, to do well personally in your managing your own assets, you basically had to be a hedge fund manager. You had to worry about what real estate was going to do, interest rates, the stock market, Fed policy. And if you got these wrong, you lost everything. Your house collapsed, you lost all your pension fund, and so on. And most people are just not set up to manage their assets on that basis. They pretty much have to go with the flow no matter what it is. So, I wish I could say there's an easy way to do this, but there isn't. All we can hope for is that our leaders move us in the right direction, even though they don't have much power to actually do that. We need to be led, essentially, in the right direction.
A lot of the top-performing hedge fund guys like John Paulson have recently moved literally billions of dollars into physical gold. And obviously, you know, since 2001, there's been a monster move up. What's your view on gold and silver?
$5,000 in 5 years. And, you know, not that gold has any real value. All gold really is a hedge against everything else going wrong. What gold really is a measure of fear in the global investment community. Fear and uncertainty. And the more of that we get, the higher the price will go. I mean, there is no industrial demand for gold. We're very close. I wish I had a gold chart here, but we're very close to breaking through an all-time high in gold. I think it's just a matter of time. And after that, I think you can see maybe 20% a year.
One subject, your talk is very comprehensive, and little that I wouldn't disagree with. There's one area that doesn't come up, and that is compared with other countries that are advancing, and of course we think of India and China, and I'm very concerned about the educational outlook in the future. I just can't see, as an old fogey maybe, that those who are getting into working age and will be getting into working age have had the opportunity or the interest to acquire the skills that are going to be needed in future decades.
You know, I actually considered this just the other day. I talked to Tom about it. Without newspapers, how do people learn how to write? You know, when I got into the newspaper business, you spent years as a copy boy. You proofread. You did the grunt work. And by grinding out thousands and thousands of stories, eventually you became a good writer. Where does someone go to do that now? Well, the internet. But you know, if you're writing your own blog on the internet, you don't have an editor, you know, so there's no learning process. And it turns out that I think good writing is going to become a lost art. Only old fogies will be able to do it. And you can take that same example and apply it to lots of industries. I'm wondering how people are going to learn how to become stockbrokers, you know, with half of the stock brokerage capacity on Wall Street wiped out. You know, those entry-level jobs just don't exist anymore. You're expected to show up there with an existing customer base and get paid a commission accordingly. So this is a big problem for a lot of kids coming out of college. I have one who, you know, I have three who have just graduated or well graduated. And they face the problem. You know what I said? Go to China. And that's where they are, is China. All my kids speak fluent Japanese, read and write. Another 6 months, they can learn Chinese because the writing is the same. And that's where they are. And, you know, going to China, you automatically start your career two rungs above the bottom just because you're white, just because you're a foreigner, because you speak English. And by the way, I did the same thing. I went to Japan in 1974. Didn't speak a word of Japanese. I knew two words, sayonara and bonsai. Got a job at a Japanese brokerage house only because I could speak English, because after the first oil shock, the only people buying stocks were Arabs. And my job was to sell Japanese stocks to Arabs. And that's what I did. You know, that wasn't on the list of prospective job opportunities at UCLA when I signed up there. So that's where the opportunities are.
Yeah, I was a stock analyst 20 years ago, and we used to trade on inside information. We all made a lot of money. We used to pay off the analysts at the brokerage firms for inside information so we could make money for our accounts. Has this changed in recent years from 20 years ago? And also, with your outlook for bad real estate prices, a weakening dollar, and the average person can't get this information, how would the average person make money in investments in future years?
Knowing the heads of many of the large hedge funds today, I would think that they would be insane to do any kind of trading remotely connected to insider information. They don't need to break the law to make money. They have no reason to. They have enough of an edge, they don't even need to go there. How does the average person invest in a world of international investments and falling stocks? Basically, everyone has a research department for free sitting on the desk in their office. There is so much information available on the internet today. It is truly staggering. I don't care how remote of an economic statistic you're looking for, you can find it in 5 minutes on the internet. You know, I can access the Bank of China website, the Ministry of Finance in Japan, their website's in English these days. You know, when I think of what I had to do to go get information, you know, going office to office in the ministry in Tokyo, and now you just go click, click, click. It really is amazing. What is harder is to put it all together, to get the big picture, the 30,000-foot view. That's one of the goals of my newsletter, is to try to put the big picture together for people. But the resources are there sitting at home. All you have to do is pick them up.
Hi. So you mentioned the challenges and complexity that comes with globalization. What about opportunities and, you know, optimism, you know, in the future?
Well, there are tremendous opportunities, but among those many opportunities are the opportunity of 2.2 billion people in India and China to come here and eat our lunch.
Yeah, you know, as Thomas Friedman wrote in his book, globalization is nothing new. It happened in the 1800s, in, you know, earlier than that. And I think, you know, there are tremendous, you know, excitement and opportunity that comes with. And my other question is, what about uncertainty in, you know, some other political environment that you, you know, brought up in your slides, that you encourage people to invest outward?
Well,
how does the uncertainty in political environment affect?
You know, the globalization has been going on since the first pre-hominid walked from Africa into the Middle East. When it was back at the level of one Dutch ship crossing the Indian Ocean, the impact on most of us would have been invisible. You know, maybe 3 years later we would have gotten some pepper on our table at an inflated price, but that was it. But, you know, running my own business, you know, I turn on my computer in the morning and I have 10 emails from India and China saying, gee, I see natural gas was up 4 cents yesterday, what should I do? You know, we're all basically living in the same bathtub now. And that is just an enormous change over a very short time. And your second question on political issues, I didn't really catch that. Could you please rephrase the question? Well, political uncertainty is something that rises and falls and which you can trade, like a stock or a bond. When I first went to China, I had to have a bodyguard. Huge crowds of people followed me. Hundreds and hundreds of people followed me because they'd never seen a foreigner before. People held their babies up as I walked by. And 5 million people had just died of famine. Now, that was 35 years ago. The political risk today in China is probably pretty small. Some would argue the political risk here is greater than it is in China, or greater than it is in many countries. After looking at some of these town hall meetings the last couple of days, I'm scared. You know, is this what we've come to? So that's just one more tradable item, and there are professional risk managers who will give you a country-by-country breakdown. I mean, they've been here. Ian Bremmer is one of them, who will tell you what the risk situation is for each country. Generally, the greater the risk, the cheaper the prices. I mean, the really smart long-term money right now is piling into Africa, where you can buy banks, telecommunication companies at PE multiples of 2. You may not be able to sell your stock for 10 years, but if conditions continue to improve in Africa, markets will develop, you'll be able to sell your stock and make a lot of money. John Templeton was a legendary investor who I was close with for many years. He made his fortune on investing in Japan in the 50s. You know, what scarier place than Japan, who just had 2 atomic bombs dropped on it? All of Templeton's great long-term returns were based on buying Hitachi at a PE multiple of 1/2. You know, not 5 times, not 2 times, 1/2 of 1. And Sony and Toyota and Mitsubishi Bank and so on. So that's another angle, but that's really more for professionals.
What's your assessment of the current stimulus program? Will it really help us to sustain the recovery, or because of its large debt component, will it eventually hurt us?
Well, Dr. Heller, first of all, I want to thank you for the A you gave me in economics. At UCLA in 1974, even though I probably didn't deserve it. You know, I think that if the government had done nothing, we would be in the Great Depression, too. Things were in such a state of free fall. All of the major banks would have gone bankrupt if we'd done nothing. There was essentially no private spending going on in the first quarter of this year. So we needed someone to prime the pump. My problem with the first stimulus package is that it was 1/3 stimulus and 2/3 pork. This was the first Democratic and Congress and president in 12 years, and there was a 12-year backlog of freeway rest areas that needed to be built and senior centers and bridges to nowhere. I mean, you know, however that money was spent, you know, so that basically was, you know, the price of admission to this recovery is that so much of that went to politically motivated spending. From here on, I think the only thing that will get through Congress is pure spending. And that's why I mentioned the interstate as one of the options to get our economy going back to a decent rate again. You know, we certainly do not have a shortage of freeways and bridges that need to be fixed. So if you concentrate the spending on that area, it will be successful. Inflationary impacts, well, it's a bit of a dilemma. The U.S. is borrowing so much now that at the first sign of an economic recovery, the inflation rate's going to go through the roof. And that's one reason I'm telling people to stay away from government bonds. They're going to get slaughtered. And I think we're going to revisit the peak government bond yields we saw in 1981 of 13, 14%, short rates at 18%. That's coming within 5 to 10 years. You know, the government has printed so much money to get this recovery going, it's really hard for them to get that back once we do get a recovery. And just as we had a collapse in the economy last year, we could get a sudden explosion in inflation very easily. So that's going to be Ben Bernanke's job to figure out, and I'm glad I don't have that job.
John, what are your thoughts about you talk about the future of America. What are your thoughts about the future of entrepreneurship in America? I mean, one of the things that has always been there is that America is a place where we're a place of ideas, and we commercialize them, and we solve problems and so forth. But it seems to me there's a lot of other places in the world that are exhibiting some pretty interesting entrepreneurship. And so what are your thoughts on entrepreneurship here and around the world, and the importance of government in terms of policies and setting the right conditions for that kind of thing, for the Silicon Valleys of energy and so forth to spring up? Comment on that, if you would.
Well, fortunately, entrepreneurship is something the United States is really, really good at, has always been good at, and will continue to be good at. After all, after we've all lost our jobs, what choice do we have but to become entrepreneurs, create our own companies, build our own businesses? It's easier to start a business here than any other place in the world. I started a company in Japan. It cost $200,000 in government fees to incorporate. I started a company in England. It cost $50,000 in accounting fees. You take it for granted that to start a company here, all you have to do is go down to the county, file a doing business as certificate for $12, and you're in business. And if you want to incorporate, you can go on the internet, and it's $100. So that's always been one of the great strengths of this country. Other countries are moving in our direction, but they're way, way behind us. I mean, this is a country of 300 million entrepreneurs, as far as I'm concerned. The idea of starting your own business and putting your own capital at risk and working your butt off to make it work, that's taking root in China and India, but it's nowhere near as prevalent as it is in the United States.
You said you think gold's going to go to 5,000 in 5 years. In 1933, the federal government confiscated all gold owned by U.S. citizens, and we weren't allowed to own gold again for 40 years. Given their propensity to do that when the going gets tough, what's another asset that would be an inflation hedge?
Well, it's a different world than it was in 1932. Remember, 1932, World War I debts were still being repaid in gold, and it was the suspension of that repayment system that caused was one of the causes of the Great Depression. I really would not want to be the politician who proposes confiscation of gold today. I don't think that would get anywhere. What's an alternative to gold? Well, you know, if conditions are that dire, nothing else is going to save you either, and I would just leave town. They have great food in Japan. Cost of living in China is low. There are a lot of places you can live, but I don't see, it's much more likely they'll take your firearms away first, and I don't even see that happening.
My question is, I've been discussing China. Some people will inform me that they think China is sort of having an artificial upturn right now with their strong stimulus package. And they were saying that when the stimulus package wears out, and most of it is going, they say, to the bigger entities versus the average people, so when that wears out, that China will go into a downturn too. And I was just wondering what your opinion is of the future of China.
Well, China is a capitalist country. It will have upturns and downturns. Things look great now, but last year their stock market went from 6,000 to 1,500, down 75%. Huge numbers of people lost all their savings. Their crash was much worse than ours. volatility works both ways, on the upside and the downside. On the other hand, if they want to do a second stimulus package of $500 billion, which is what the first one was, all they have to do is sell some treasury bonds. They have the cash. They're not doing this, from a deficit. Sell cash, sell some gold, sell some of their copper. That's no problem. The big problem China has is actually executing these plans. It is an emerging country. It does have 1.2 billion people. On a good day, their control of what's going on in that country is marginal at best. It's sort of a semi-controlled anarchy is the way you can realistically view China. So, but the bottom line is they work hard, they save, they have a huge desire to improve their standard of living, and over time, that's going to be a great place to invest your money, just like the United States was in 1900. We're basically in the same position. Actually, China's probably about where we were in 1850 in terms of standard of living.
With regards to carbon cap and trade, you specifically mentioned one firm, Goldman Sachs, and I'm wondering why.
Well, they have already set up a unit that is very profitable, which is trading cap and trade credits in Europe. It's based in Paris. And whenever a new financial product comes out, the firms with the greatest trading expertise and experience end up making the most money. And that's Goldman Sachs. In 1990 or 1989, the Japanese government authorized Japanese government bond futures. Goldman Sachs went in there. The first day the market opened, there was a bid, and Goldman Sachs spent about 3 seconds typing into a computer, said, I think that's expensive, hit the bid. And then they hit the next one, the next one, the next one. Their model said these bond futures were vastly overpriced. They made $50 million the first month. That was a lot of money in those days, especially in Japan. And the Japanese institutions were kind of going, wow, what was that? They just lost $50 million. The cap and trading, could exceed the stock market in terms of value traded, trading volumes, and profits made.
Thank you.
John, is capitalism at risk, or will we just make adjustments, or will it be adjusted? But what about the isms, the socialisms, the capitalisms?
I don't see us going back to Marx and Engels. I think by now they're pretty thoroughly discredited. The government, although it seems large and omnipotent from here, the reality is the U.S. government is really too small to influence very much at all. I mean, what is the U.S. government? It's the military, it's the post office, and a lot of tax collectors, and the overhead. They really don't have much of an impact on influencing us, the world economy, or the U.S. economy, and they don't have the money to do it. That leaves the rest of us pretty much on our own. I mean, this is probably more of a libertarian country than a capitalist one. That's one of the reasons we had a financial crisis last year. If the government were in control of everything, that never would have happened. Prices never would have gone up. They never had stock market crashes in the Soviet Union. You had controlled prices on everything. Gasoline was 25 cents a gallon until the day the Soviet government fell. You never could find any, but it was the official price was 25 cents a gallon. So, I tend not to get caught up in ideology too much. I'm really looking more at valuations and cash flows. You got the mic.
Question here. In one of your early slides, you had a comment about endemic deflation. At the same time, there's the risk of inflation. do you see deflation and inflation as sort of vacillating, or
we could go one way or the other at this point, and we could get both. I mean, certainly we've had deflation. If your house isn't dropping by half, isn't deflation? I don't know what is. On the other hand, at the rate the government is borrowing and printing money, it's the equivalent of pouring gasoline all over the place, but no one has any matches. The second someone lights a match, kabang, it goes. And I watched the inflation of the 70s, which then was largely commodity-based. And there again, governments have very little ability to do much about it. So, deflation first, then inflation. I think that's the most likely scenario. Hopefully, the inflation will be controllable. Ben Bernanke's done a pretty good job so far, but, he can only pull so many rabbits out of a hat. And with the monetary base expanding at a 20% rate right now, there's a lot of risk out there, and I think they understand that.
John, this is all very, very interesting, and I think we could go on talking for quite some time about it, and I believe that you have some time to stay after, and people have other questions. I'm going to ask them to come up front to see you. So the Commonwealth Club does have the certain strictures on time, and we've gone a little bit over, but I would like to give you just an opportunity. You've provided, obviously, a number of insights and gems and nuggets here for us this evening. What are one or two things that you'd really like to leave with us by way of summary out of all of these many insights that you've provided us?
The future is in your hands. It's totally up to you. The resources are you have the resources. You can find out anything you want online. You just have to have the confidence in your own abilities, and you'll deliver a future that's great for yourself, if not for the whole country. And no, I'm not running for office.
Well, I want to thank John Thomas, hedge fund industry veteran, for his tremendous thanks very much, John, for those insights. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.